Blog Talk Radio.
Hey folks,
hey,
welcome to our Yule show. As you can see, Joy and I are in our usual finest, I don't know, mindset, ready and raring to go.
Talking over the thing.
True.
Anyway, Ryan was going to do the whole intro. Since we seem to have stepped on each other's toes, I'm just going to go ahead and do it and say this is episode 9. It's our Yule show. It's originally being broadcast on the 19th of December, and that means that Yule is actually 2 days away. On the 21st of 2013, which means that Christmas is only a few days after that. But we're not going to be talking about Christmas because everybody else does. Before we get to that, though, I do want to make a few announcements to the people that are listening live or listening to it recorded here. We're going to be changing some of the format of the show. You may have seen as an announcement on our website that we have changed the format from a two-hour show every week to a two-hour show every other week. This is going to cause several things. First off, it's going to allow us to better prepare for the shows so that we have our facts and our research straight. It's also going to let us have a little breathing room because he and I both still have, you know, mundane jobs that we go to and earn money from. And mine is early enough in the morning that by 7 p.m. at night when I'm recording this live, usually I'm passing out and going to sleep. So we're going to start pre-recording the shows also, which means that they're not going to be live anymore. They will still stream on Blog Talk Radio more than likely, and we are going to set up a podcast account on iTunes and the other various podcast broadcasters that are out there. They will also always be archived on our website, magicalmusings.net, and you're welcome to come and listen to any of them at any point in time. Download them, save them on your computer. You know, it's not a big deal. We'd love to, for you to do that. Share them with your classes if you have them or your covens. That's, you know, part of the purpose that we're doing this is to try to get more of the information out there in the electronic media so people will, you know, use it as a resource and so we can start slowly expanding the pool of knowledge that we have with paganism and all of the other stuff since the books don't cover it. We're also in the new year going to be getting off of Blog Talk Radio. Brian is currently paying for the entire account, which allows us to broadcast a two-hour show with the chat room and the call-in number and everything like that. And as far as I know, it's gotten to be, you know, a bit of a financial drain because you know, I don't have an account there, but as far as I know, it's kind of expensive, and we want to try to remove that from him so that he can still, you know, afford to have electricity and food and stuff like that. So, like I said, we're going to start recording everything and putting it up on the website. And so those are the announcements. And if... I'm a little leery to say this because Brian and I haven't really talked about it. We may even scale this back from a two-hour show to a one-hour show. But that, if that happens, is going to be probably far in the future. Right now, we've got topics enough to go into mid-March. We've pretty much used up most of our resources thinking of them. So please, if you have an idea or something that you would like us to talk about or research and put up, drop us a line at magicalmusings.net. There's contact form there on the About Us page, or you can email Joy at magicalmusings.net or Brian at magicalmusings.net. You can get us through our Tumblr accounts. He's cosmic-rebirth.tumblr.com, and mine is wide-worlds, with an S, -joy.tumblr.com. And, you know, we'd love to hear back from you guys. So all of that out of the way, let's get into the meat of the night, Yule.
Exactly. Well, I mean, obviously, Yule is not an English word. It came to English through the, I think it was Old Norse, or, you know, a Germanic language of some sort, from a word meaning wheel. And, I mean, there's different ideas about what that origin means, but ultimately, in the modern pagan sense, I like to think of it as referring to the wheel of the year. But, you know, I don't know. Joy, what are your thoughts on that?
I'm sorry. I was looking at the information that we've got on the Christmas tree here. so I was trying to...
All right.
See, this is why live shows are kind of a hard thing. You were talking about...
I can certainly vamp a bit.
Well, you know, I don't want to do the standard joke of you'll love it, you know, because that's kind of old. It's killed for me by Scrooge. But it's, you know, summer solstice is, or I'm sorry, winter solstice. Summer solstice in the southern hemisphere. But winter solstice.
Joy's
is,
already on vacation.
I am, apparently.
Joy's mind is
gotta...
on vacation in Australia. That's how we're explaining that.
Well, understand something. As listeners might remember, I became unemployed several months ago. I got reemployed about a month ago, and I had one of my big tests from the training today. So it's like, okay, my brain is coming down off of hyper spaz mode. So I'm a little scattered at this point. Anyhow, winter solstice. It is very much a turning point of the year. I mean, you can't sit outside and live with nature and be involved with the cycles of the seasons and not notice the solstices and the equinoxes. The equinoxes might, you know, get passed by because it's kind of hard to judge that the night is exactly the same as the day unless you stay up all night. But, you know, when the days start getting longer, when they're first getting all shorter and shorter and shorter and the sun is going away, and then suddenly they start getting longer and longer and longer, something happened at that point. And I would think the primitive man would have seen that and gone, oh, okay, thank goodness, because now the sun is coming back and we're going to live. And
definitely.
Getting real relief, having a celebration because the sun is returning. And that's go ahead.
Sorry. What I mean, one of the things that happens generally, primarily because of something called axial tilt, that is, if anyone is aware that we live on a planet that spins, and that it, you know, the sun itself is actually technically, I mean, it's moving around the Milky Way galaxy, but in relation to the planet Earth, it's fixed in, you know, in a position, and the Earth itself is spinning around and doing its thing, you know, and that's why we have days and years and so on. But what happens at the same time is that as the Earth is spinning in its daily cycle of rotation, the two poles of the north and south are actually moving in the sky. Well, they're moving generally. It changes the way that we view the sky. And what happens from Earth perspective is that the sun moves north and south in the course of the year. Now, the winter solstice, the sun is the farthest south speaking in Northern Hemisphere terms, that it's going to be all year. And what happens over the course of that year is that it moves, you know, gradually, and then at winter solstice, it stays in one position for about 3 days. So
now we got to clarify a little bit here. This is him. He's saying that this is where the sun is rising, is the furthest south, and then it creeps up back towards the north, right?
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
And I mean, you can talk about various cultures and their observation of that. I mean, it likely happened over generations. And different cultures obviously took note of that, because what results from the sun moving south in the course of the year, especially at winter solstice, is that the days get shorter and the nights get longer.
Uh-huh.
And if you were in a superstitious culture that relied on the sun for warmth, light, you know, everything, I mean, we still do technically, but if that was something that, you know, you paid a lot of attention to because, you know, your food came straight off the land instead of, you know, all year round out of supermarkets. The fact that the days were shortening and the nights were lengthening might kind of cause you some concern.
More than a little, I would think. I mean, let's face it, the most obvious change in either hemisphere, actually, is the temperature change. Simply getting exposed to the sunlight for an additional 2 hours a day causes a dramatic shift in the temperature of whatever area that you're in. There are certain crops that love cold weather, like evergreens and junipers and mistletoe and, holly and some forms of wheat. There's a couple of species of grapes, I think, they grow in Iceland don't mind the cold. But most plant material in winter dies out, and you have to go to some extreme measures at times to preserve them. I mean, I don't know how many people have been down to where they grow a lot of citrus, but during the winter, especially when there's a cold snap, they put up these huge canopies over their citrus trees and put warming pots in with the trees to keep them alive so that they don't all die out, you know. And these are usually very, very warm climes anyway. So, you know, the temperature drops down to 20 degrees, and you could have, you know, hundreds of thousands and upwards to millions of dollars worth of produce ruined, you know, in a couple of hours. So, yeah, you work really hard to make sure that the food that you have is going to still be there in a few months. That's what we're really talking about, because we're talking about an agrarian hunter-gatherer agriculture that agricultural
society.
Thank you. Culture, agricultural culture, where you know it's you're really part of all of the season, and so keeping the plants alive so that you have more next year, even if it's not producing anything right now, is pretty important. And I think that's a lot of why some of the deity forms and some of the what we're taught now in modern paganism came to be. For instance, remember the Celts were a nocturnal society. They started counting their days from sundown until the next sundown. So their first part of their day, their morning, was nighttime when it's all dark outside. It's theorized that the ancestors of the Celts from 400 BCE to about 200 BCE is the general range of Celts that we're talking about. It's theorized that their ancestors like 10,000 BCE or, you know, right around there, actually came from a desert climb where if you were out when the sun was in the sky, you were dead because it was just too hot and you would sweat and you would burn and you would fall over. So they would move during the night and they would take shelter during the day so that they could continue to live, like most of the animals that stayed in that area. So the winter was the start of their year, which is why most pagans and most Wiccans and those that observe the solar cycle with the four fire season or fire festivals and the greater Sabbats typically have Samhain as New Year's, because that is the official changeover, really, from the light half of the year, the summer, when the goddess is ascendant, to the time period where the god takes over and provides food through the hunting. In Sayax Wicca, what you have is you have not really rulership, but spheres of influence. The plants are growing during the summer because you're able to harvest more grains and more green leafy things and get more vitamin C, and there's more solar energy available for the plants. The goddess is the person that is providing all of that. So she has primary ascendancy during that time period. She's honored from Beltane to Samhain. That is her time of the year. From Samhain to Beltane again is the Lord's time. The Lord is normally somebody that is a hunter. He is the Beast Lord, Hearn, Cernunnos. He takes care of the people, meaning the culture that worships him, through the hunt and through providing the animals who aren't going to make it through the winter so that the people have something to eat, since there's very few plants for them to eat. And then the changeover comes in Beltane, and this cycle keeps repeating. Through UPG, which, if you recall, is Unverified Personal Gnosis, which means basically this was an epiphany that I had one night, and it just made sense. You really got to understand that, yes, the deities rest just like we do. They need their time to lay down and go to sleep. Okay, so if Beltane and Samhain are their times of transition from one to the other, and you have Imbolc and Mabon, or Lusnada, marking the middle periods of their ascendancy, then when reasonably would you have the deities actually laying down and going to sleep? And the answer would be during the solstices, and they would wake up on the equinoxes. So what you have is, starting from Samhain, you have the transition from Lady to Lord, okay? And then from Samhain to Yule, the Lady is still awake. She's still there. She's available for her people. But she's tired. She's been up 9 months, okay? So at Yule, she lays down. She goes to sleep. The blankets of snow cover her, and he's up overnight and taking care of everybody and making sure the animals are reproducing and that the people can still eat and everything. And we have Imbolc, which is mid-January, or end of January, which is the Festival of Lights, which brings him energy so that he can continue to go on, because this is the midpoint of his rulership. Then at the spring equinox, she wakes up, okay, and the life is coming back into the world, and the plants are starting to stand up, and they're, you know, running around, and the animals are, you know, getting into, okay, it's time to mate, and we're going to do this now. And, you know, he's been doing his job all of this time. Now, he's still in charge of everything, but all this energy starts moving, and so she wakes up. Okay. Now, she's still groggy. She's been asleep for 3 months. She needs her coffee. She needs to put her face on. And then she can actually go to work at Beltania, where it's a big old fire festival and everybody's having sex with everything. And you continue on from there. And this made logical sense to me. It made me think that, okay, the gods are just like us. They have good moods and bad moods. They have times that they need to be with each other. And I'm sure that there's points in there just before one of them goes to sleep or the other is waking up that they're going, and, you know, jumping all over each other and having sex themselves, especially at Beltania when the energy and the fertility of the earth is brought back. But remember, after Samhain, the energy and the fertility for the herds and the wild animals is just as important, okay? So he takes that energy and he puts it into the survival of the species and their propagation throughout the winter and the weeding out of the weak. Because let's face it, you know, if you've got a diseased deer who is, you know, hurt, come prey food. And the wolves are going to hunt it down and they're going to kill it because it can't run away fast enough. And thus the herd becomes stronger because the ones that are healthy and have the best genes can get away. And the ones that have broken their hoof or don't have their horns anymore and can't defend themselves are the ones that are pulled down and killed. This is one of the things where I feel the stewardship of the humans, of the earth, in the hands of the humans really falls down, and that's in hunting. Bit of a side note here. I'm an advocate of responsible hunting, and I understand that there's always going to be hunting, and people are always going to go out and kill animals. It's my considered opinion that that's good as long as they follow the patterns of the wild and take the diseased and take the injured instead of killing the best and greatest. You don't kill the 17-point buck simply because you can. Even if you use everything, you kill the bachelor who lost his bid to try to take over the herd back in the spring, who no girl will look at, and you know use all of that.
Well, that's very true. I mean, nature has a different approach to life and death. And I think during the winter too, you get into this sort of necessary dynamic where in a culture that relies on the sun coming up every day, as one of their gods, for instance, the fact that it disappears or that the sky, you know, the nights lengthen would imply then that that god is growing weaker during the course of the year. And in the, you know, in the lowest point in the sky, you could say that he's died. I mean, this, if you want to get technical, is an astrotheological explanation for the timing of even the birth of Christ. I mean, you've got like the end of the year, the darkness of the sky, the fear that dark will last forever, that, you know, the cold will continue and, you know, the world will die under a blanket of snow or, you know, just in the freezing cold. And you've got the solstice, longest night, and then following that, what you end up with is a period of time, 3 days, in fact, at which point you notice the lengthening days. The sun is in the sky longer, and it increases as you go farther from the solstice.
And coincidentally enough, that's right around the 25th.
Well, exactly. And that, I mean, when you're talking about, like, the Romans, for instance, you've got, like, Mithras. The Mithras cult was built around the same kind of astrotheological explanation. You know, the darkness of the sky, the fact that the days grew longer, so that must be the time the sun was born, you know. And Mithras in this case was the solar deity associated with the creation of the world, because he slayed a particular bull that, you know, whose blood basically gave birth to the universe.
Well, according to Iranian mythology, Mithra was born at the end of the solstice night.
That makes sense. I mean, you've got the same kind of mythology surrounding Christ's birth, too. I mean, okay. Oh, yes. Actually, you know what's interesting, too, is the whole idea with astrotheology especially, it addresses that very point. And what happens in the Northern Hemisphere, at least, during the winter, is that the presence of Orion in the sky becomes more conspicuous. In ancient Egypt, he was known as Osiris. But basically, the constellation of Orion has a belt of three stars that line up, actually, and right around the winter solstice, those three stars point to Sirius, which is the star in the east that was said to be followed by the wise men in the Bible, obviously. But what happens with Sirius is it actually marks the place on the horizon where the sun comes up following the solstice. So the winter solstice, the sun comes up to follow the star in the sky, where the star has pointed where the sun is going to be born. Three wise men, or the belt stars of Orion, have pointed to this star in the east, followed it to where the sun is born. So the same mythology surrounds Mithras, Jesus, probably Baldur, I don't know, because I'm not like well versed anymore in Norse mythology. But
yeah, we'd have to study that. But yeah, it's just more evidence that every religion rips off from every other religion, you know. Because as far as I can tell, Mithras was first, then came Christianity, then came modern pagan movements. Islam, then came modern pagan movements, pretty much, and they're all incestuously mixed together, so that it's really hard to trace the absolute origin of any one myth back to its original place. I know quite a number of people that have dedicated their lives to doing this, and they keep finding more clues of different cultures who have the exact same myth in them. And, you know, people are like, oh, that's evidence that God is overall and everything. And no, it's evidence that people actually communicated in the past. Imagine that.
That's crazy talk. There aren't trading routes that span the globe in those days.
No.
What I think we're going to do is actually play a song from Sharon Knight called Osiris Lives from her album Songs for the Waning Year, so that Joy and I can take a break from talking, and you can enjoy this really cool song, actually. I quite like it. It's only a little 2.5-minute one, but you might like it, and, you know, you may want to invest in Sharon's albums, which are great and are available on iTunes. So here's Sharon Knight, Osiris Lives.
Red barley and grape on the vine, green waters of the rising Nile. Red barley and grape on the vine, green waters of the rising Nile. Osiris lives, Osiris returns. What is true will never die. Osiris lives, Osiris returns. What is true will never die. Red barley and grape on the vine, green waters of the rising Nile. waters of the rising Nile. The fire and grape on the vine, green waters of the rising Nile. Osiris lives, Osiris returns. What is true will never die. Osiris lives, Osiris returns. What is true will never die. Red body and grape on the vine, green waters of the rising Nile. Red body and grape on the vine, green waters of the rising Nile. Osiris lives, Osiris returns. What is true will never die. Osiris lives, Osiris returns. What is true will never die.
All right, well, we're back now. Hope you all enjoyed that song. Let's see. The something that was touched upon in the last half hour is the understand that my tradition of Wicca is very different from most of the traditional traditions of Wicca, at least the ones that are what's considered, I don't know, correct Wicca among some. I know that Gardnerian and Alexandrian have a cycle of death and rebirth, which culminates right around now in the Yule celebration, that's the Oak King and the Holly King. And if I remember correctly, essentially what you have is a cycle similar to the dark half and light half of the year that I already talked about with Sayax Wicca, except instead of swapping off between the male and female, you swap off between two kings. And one is the Oak King, and that's the king that's usually ascendant during the summer months, and the other is the Holly King, which is ascendant during the winter months. The problem is that if I'm remembering correctly, and I may be incorrect with this, Yule is the time period when the two contend, and the Oak King will put down the will kill the Holly King, and start his time ruling on the earth. And the Oak King will be in the light half, up on the surface of the planet, and supposedly the Holly King goes into the underworld, where he rules over the dead and the dark areas and everything for his 6 months. This would naturally bring the summer solstice as the time of transition between from when the Oak King goes to the underworld and the Holly King is now ascendant and ruling the upper bright world. Another piece of unverified personal gnosis that I shared with a couple of people that just sort of made them stop in stunned confusion for a little while until they thought about it was that, okay, you're dealing with a faith is Eurocentric, okay? Europe is the be-all, end-all, and it's where everything comes from, okay? So you have a deity that is ruling the summer months from the start of summer, supposedly, at midsummer until midwinter, and then going to some place under the ground. Well, on a sphere, if you go far enough underground, where do you wind up? In the other hemisphere. The southern hemisphere, in fact.
What?
Yeah.
Traveling on a round object means you go to the other half? Crazy.
When you go deep enough. And so it would be logical, and another one of those things about, that if we had a society that was actually, that actually understood that we were on a ball, and this is one of those observable phenomenons by simply looking at a lunar eclipse where you can see the obvious circular shadow of the planet on the moon, that they could come up with a tradition or a thought that their deity, instead of going into a hell-like area, which is, you know, underground and burning and volcanoes and everything like that, they just go to the opposite side of the planet where they rule there for half the year. And at that point in time, they're deposing the other king and taking over their job. So they're just swapping jobs every 6 months, essentially, like a giant Rubik's Cube or something. And I was like, wow, that's really, really interesting when you stop and think about it. And the people that I expressed this to were like, wow, that's really, really interesting when you stop and think about it. And just about everybody that I've explained that to that understands what I'm trying to say is like, wow, that's really, really interesting when you stop and think about it. But it would make sense, don't you think?
Fair enough.
Mm. Then there's the cycle where you have a singular deity, where his power waxes and wanes as the sun's influence waxes and wanes. Now, in this myth cycle that I think some other traditional pagan groups are practicing, there's a singular deity. There's not a dual deity that swaps places. He is born on the winter solstice, much like Jesus, interesting, lives his life, grows up, gets to the height of his power somewhere in the summer, probably right around, June 21st maybe, and then slowly gets older and more decrepit as the year goes on until he has sex with the lady somewhere in the latter half of the year, gets her pregnant, and then he kicks off at Yule, interestingly enough, right about the time she's giving birth to him again. And so you have this cycle of waxing and waning for the solar deity throughout that myth cycle. Now, in this one, the lady is always ascendant. She, you know, changes her moods and faces as the moon changes faces, and gets more powerful and then, you know, goes quiet and gets more powerful and goes more quiet. But she's more immediate because she's right there with the people all the time. The god in this myth cycle is not as prominent, but once again in the summer months, he's very, very much, very, very important. And I think personally this was the origin of the standard myth of the Father Time, who is a baby at New Year, gets older and older and older and older and finally dies at New Year, and there's a new baby there who gets older and older and older and dies at New Year. So this would be another one of those things that, you know, it's another serendipity type thing. You can see the origins if you look at it. Unfortunately, a lot of the books don't really go deep into these types of myth cycles because they don't sell. You know, you tell them, you tell the people that are buying the books that, oh, yes, Yule is the shortest day of the year and the sun is coming back and it's all wonderful and we celebrate on the 25th, and then you don't go into any of the rest of it. Except the rest of it gives this depth and real substance to the myth, in my opinion, and really adds dimensions to it. You can also see a lot of the thoughts that possibly the Northmen, the Norse, had when they were dealing with Unter and their solar god. Remember, Balder was a deity of the sun. Okay, he was the most beautiful thing ever. They were extremely concerned with ice and the frost giants and winter. And, I mean, I don't know how many people out there have watched the Game of Thrones or read it, but, you know, winter is coming and the winter is long. Could have come straight out of the Norse thought patterns because they were very obsessed. Go ahead.
Sorry, I mean, I think that with Game of Thrones, I mean, that's predominantly where you get that idea, but, I mean, in that and in Tolkien's work, I mean, you can pretty much identify which cultures are represented by which race, or in the Game of Thrones case, which kingdom represents which, you know, culture. And I think, too, that with in the case of Balder, I mean, his mythology surrounds basically the birth of, like, the perfect son. He's, like, the best-looking, he's the most talented, he's like, intelligent, and he's athletic, and he's basically, like, the perfect all-around son. You've got, I mean, myths of Sunna and Mani, who are the goddess of the sun and the god of the moon, but Baldur's mythology is basically surrounding this idea that this perfect son was killed. I mean, he was born basically immortal, unkillable. There's nothing that can destroy him except for the one plant that his mother talked to or couldn't get to agree not to kill her son. And Loki found
this
out.
She missed getting a promise from it.
Well, exactly. And
she didn't think it was important enough.
Well, because it's a parasitic plant. I mean, it lives off another plant that was great and powerful and, you know, was one of their central plants. And, mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, obviously, before her son was born, she had everything in the entire known world and universe make a vow not to kill her son. However, the mistletoe, because she didn't think it was significant, Loki found out because he was in disguise as a woman, apparently. he tricked her into telling him, and then he made a dart, basically, out of mistletoe wood. And then had this... There was a feast in the hall of, I want to say, Odin. And they were basically tossing stuff, like any conceivable weapon or thing they could throw at Balder. They were basically taking turns
showing off.
Well, yes, but that's the whole central thing of the culture. And Loki tricked the blind guy in the room into throwing the little mistletoe dart. Was it Hod?
Yes.
Honir.
We just looked it up.
Somebody. Anyway, yeah, he got tricked into throwing this little mistletoe dart at Balder, the only thing in the entire known universe that could kill him, and he falls dead. Now, of course...
Gosh, my goodness, who would have thunk?
Well, exactly. And, I mean, this is the origin of the whole punishment of Loki, that he's chained into a cave and, you know, has a viper hung over him that drops acid on him, and every time it hits him, you know, the earth shakes. Basically, his wife is holding a vessel above his head, catching all the venom so that he doesn't do this, and then he gets hit with it when she empties it out. So obviously, he shakes the world, earthquakes, etc. It's all very neatly tied together, but basically this is kind of the idea that Baldur is kind of the, I mean, this, it depends on who you're reading, but basically Baldur's considered the Christ of the Norse pantheon, and he's the one that's celebrated in some traditions of modern Assatur, etc. So,
and understand, you know, when you've got a culture that's obsessed with the sun, and the ice in the winter, losing their sun god is a huge, huge thing. I mean, it's a sign of Ragnarok is coming, and the ice giants are going to rise up, and they're going to wipe out everybody. Because remember, Ragnarok states that, you know, most of the gods die. All of humanity, except for very few bits and pieces, die. And, you know, it's a wonderful story to read in depth because it slays who and what's going on, and there's heroics, and the people that are left and the deities that are left start the world anew. Well, that's great that it starts the world anew, and there's going to be, you know, humanity and the gods again and everything, but it kind of sucks for the people that are dead because they're not going to be there for it. So, you know, Ragnarok is not something to be courted, and it's not something that you want to pursue. It's, you know, the start of the end of the world. And even though it's reborn, it doesn't help the people that died getting it, okay? So this is not, you know, this is something that you want to prevent at all costs. So when Loki, you know, gets Hod to kill Baldur and then disguises himself as a giantess and refuses to mourn that Baldur's dead, and that, so that Hel will release him from her domain, Niflheim, I believe, or no, Helheim. She you know, won't release him at that point, you know, and so they're going to be even madder at him. And this is after, you know, decades of him being abused by the rest of the gods. I mean, he created Sepplinir, he created the Odin's spear, Mjolnir. He had created Sif's hair. Several magical artifacts, you know, and were distributed. And he keeps getting blamed for everything that goes wrong, you know. And so he's pissed off at this point. And frankly, I don't blame him. If it had been me, I'd be, you know, just as pissed off and going, oh, so we got Golden Boy Baldur here. Okay, he thinks he's so, yeah, right. Okay, let's find out what's going to hurt him. And I can imagine that he probably didn't think that the dart would kill him. But I don't think that he cried too much when it did. But that's just me. You know, I'm looking at it through the perspective of Loki is not the evil deity that everybody says he is, but he's a deity of chaos change.
Well,
you know, and so the myth of Baldur and the death of Baldur fits right in with that.
Exactly. And it all ties to...
and it does.
But
sorry, for our new listeners, this is a standing running joke. It kind of means that we've gone off on a track that we didn't think that we would get to, but it all relates back to what we're talking about anyway.
It may seem like it's loose association, but it does actually tie in. Now, the thing with part of our celebration is, okay, we're only, you know what, we could do another song if you want, or we could go straight into the second hour stuff.
Let's go ahead and go into second hour stuff. It's close enough.
All right. Basically, one of the things that ties together that everyone thinks about at this time of year is a jolly old elf by the name of Saint Nicholas. Now, the interesting thing is with him, he's got a little bit of history to him. And he's got different faces throughout the world, actually. Which, I mean, they've all basically contributed their parts to what we know as Santa Claus today. But originally, depending on where in the world you are, you've got different influences. Saint Nicholas was actually a dude in, I want to say like Turkey or Iraq or somewhere around that part of the world. And
Turkey.
He was actually, was it Turkey? And he was actually a saint because of the fact that when he was doing his thing in those days, he was a bishop. And one of the things that he would do is go around once a year to kind of give food and needed items to the children in, you know, the poorer neighborhoods around where he lived. And he would do this.
Imagine being a Christian at Christmas.
Well, exactly. I mean, he would basically do this every, you know, every year, and he would do it anonymously, so nobody really knew that it was happening. And one of the stories that's told about him is that he was in this inn, like a, I don't know, probably a cheesy dive of a motel or a pub with some rooms up above it, and he'd been offered a meal by the innkeeper. And he figured, well, you know, why not? But he was kind of suspicious because of the fact that this dude was offering roast meat in a neighborhood in a time of poverty. And so he went into the kitchen kind of curious to know what the hell was going on with that. And to his horror, this innkeeper basically butchering a couple of dead kids so that he could roast them and, you know, they could eat meat. St. Nicholas, you know, who I guess you could call Nick, basically freaked out when this happened. And he got on his knees and he prayed for these children to be spared this horrible end. And lo and behold, they came back to life.
Ooh.
So Nick got sainted.
Cue the spooky music.
Exactly. Although, any Christian music about that would probably be scary. Anyway, so yeah, you've got the Middle East influence on Santa Claus. You've got stories in Northern Europe, around Siberia, you know, and Finland and Sweden and so on. Basically the whole Northern European continent.
Mm-hmm.
Of the mighty shaman, who apparently, according to a few different authors, were basically collecting mushrooms. And everyone's familiar with these marvelous little things. You see them in the Smurf cartoons. You see them in Christmas ornaments, strangely enough. You see them all over the place. And these are the Amanita muscaria mushrooms, the red ones with the white spots, the toadstool, associated with Wicca, or witches, I should say, and tripping out. They're well known. And apparently, what would happen is these shamans would go around the forests during, you know, spring, summer, fall, and pick mushrooms. I am.
Uh-oh.
They would go, have you disappeared?
No, it's just you faded out on me. Yeah.
Oh, goody.
Oh, it's okay. It's probably just my computer. So
right,
keep going.
So. Anyway, yeah, so they would basically harvest these mushrooms through the course of the year, and they would hang them in fir trees to dry them, because a dry mushroom weighs a hell of a lot less than a wet one. And they're less likely to damage the ones at the bottom of the bag. So what would happen is they would dry these mushrooms, and then they would pack them away, and, you know, they might trip on them or whatever. But they'd basically save them for the dark time of the year when snow covered the houses of the village, and the only access he had was through the smoke hole of the house, or the chimney, as we now know it. And he would climb in, and he would leave mushrooms for the children. Now, why would he do this? Interestingly enough, turns out that there's different there's different degrees of effect that the Amanita muscarias have. Now, when you ingest them yourself, you get a certain effect. However, if, as the shamans did, basically, if you drink urine from someone or something that has consumed Amanita muscaria, you get all the benefits of the psychedelic trip without all the harmful effects that will damage your liver. Now, why is that? Why would you give that to children? Because the kids eat the mushrooms and the parents drink their pee. Gross? Slightly.
More than, yeah.
Well, I'm sure there are urine fetishists who are kind of like, oh my God, I like this idea.
Let's move on, okay?
Okay, anyway. Now,
oh, goodness.
Here's the thing with that. Basically, how did the shamans learn about the whole idea of drinking urine to get the effects of mushrooms? Basically, they watched reindeer eating mushrooms and drinking or eating the yellow snow. Now, what happens when a reindeer eats mushrooms? He trips out. He gets the notion that he's flying, at least it seems like he does, and a flying reindeer tied to a mushroom-eating shaman who delivers mushrooms to children through their chimneys. Strange thing. It's a strangely familiar concept. So, what you get here, and I mean, it even ties into the whole concept of Santa Claus wearing red and white. People think that it dates back to when Coca-Cola decided that, you know what, let's take this dude's poem. I want to say Clement Moore. I think that's right. Wrote.
Mary
a
has
poem
confirmed
about...
that is that.
Excellent. And yeah, so basically, you take this dude who wrote a poem about a fat elf who comes down the chimney and delivers toys to kids. Now, basically, you paint him red and white. People think that's something that Coca-Cola did for their advertising campaigns. It predates that. It dates back to the very colors of the Amanita muscaria mushroom, red and white. And before that, I mean, the whole idea of Father Christmas probably connected with the theme of the Holly King, because the old Father Christmas in England and, you know, in Europe, basically, was connected more to green and earthy colors. So what you get here is the tie-in with varying colors that are associated with the holiday. And then you move on to mainland Europe, and Santa is seen very differently there. You've got, obviously, the shaman connection, the mushrooms, etc. But you've also got, in different parts of, like, the Germanic countries, particularly Bavaria now, you've got tradition where Santa was just a little gnome kind of a thing, and he rode around on a little goat and he brought gifts for the children. His name was Tomten in that region, and he was accompanied by this weird goblin-y sort of thing who punished children for being horrible.
Krampus.
Basically, Krampus is one of his manifestations. And yeah, I mean, there's a whole crazy load of tie-ins with the whole idea of Santa Claus and, you know, actually it's kind of cool. In the Alpine countries, they still celebrate Krampus with a, like, I think it's December 1st, where people, like, dress up in these elaborate Krampus costumes and they parade around, you know, in their little towns dressed as Krampuses, and it's like the time of year when people dress in horns and they carry whips and, you know, birch switches, and basically they whip each other, and, you know, it's kind of like celebration of the darkness and the devil because of an opportunity to vent the darkness, I guess, in, you know, in preparation for celebrating the feast and, you know, in the light of Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so anything you want to throw in there, Joy?
I'm fascinated by this, everything that you're saying. This is great. And Mary's, you know, throwing in her little bits as we come to it, and Krampus and things like that. See, Clement Moore wrote The Night Before Christmas. Not The Nightmare Before Christmas. Oh, God. All right. Thank you. I love that. Anyway. The illustrator for the Coca-Cola thing is Sundbloom, who started the whole St. Nicholas, Santa Claus campaign thing. And I didn't actually, everything that you were saying about St. Nicholas, I didn't know. And it's very interesting because there's been a huge thing going on here, at least in the United States, about how it's theorized that because St. Nicholas was Turkish, that he was dusky colored, as some politically correct people would say, that he had very, very dark skin and could be seen as black. And people are, you know, going, oh, that means Santa Claus was, you know, from India or from Iran and that he was a terrorist. And no, we have to have our lily white Christian Santa Claus, you know, and it's like, get over it. Once again, this is, you know, we're all descended from people from genetic Eve, who was in Africa, and so it doesn't matter whether he was a black man or a white man. Heck, Jesus was probably black, so, you know, I'm going to get killed now.
it's a matter of really acknowledging where these myths come from, right? I mean, the fact that Nicholas, it's a Greek name, but I mean, you've got Greek influence all over the Middle East and stuff because of trade routes, go figure. The fact is Nicholas came from Turkey. The fact that he's not, you know, Northern European pale skinned doesn't really change his story.
Right.
He was probably the same.
Remember that, you know, they've, like with the deity myths that we've been talking about, they've taken stories from a lot of different cultures and mushed them together to make the Santa Claus that we think we know and love. I mean, because here's the mythology here. We've got Santa Claus, who was a Catholic saint. Okay, well, we also have Santa Claus, who is a giant elf. And then we've also got Santa Claus, who's a very generous gentleman in Scandinavia. And then we've got Santa Claus, who is, you know, and they're all making up the same set of myths for the same person. And people, you know, oh, he's a Catholic saint that can put his finger next to his nose and go up a chimney. And people don't see the dichotomy there, and they reconcile it somehow by just not thinking about it, apparently. Anyway.
Well, I mean, the simple truth is that Santa Claus, as we visualize him now, is he's kind of a mishmash of different things. I mean, he's become what he is because of all these past influences, and it doesn't invalidate who Santa Claus is. The myth of him is it's a warm and fuzzy feeling that's very appropriate to this time of year, because you've got this feeling of cold, this the sense of isolation in particularly rural villages and so on, where people were kept inside because they were, you know, trying to stay warm and stay close to the fire and stuff. So stories of a magical being who comes through, you know, their chimney or their door or whatever, to deliver gifts to the children is, it's a nice sentiment for this time of year, because this is a time of year that, you know, in ancient cultures would have been associated with the possibility of basically freezing to death. Nowadays, because we have the comforts of... Sorry, go ahead.
No, it's, you know, he's drowned with a child eating deer, you know? So
well,
we've got that too.
And actually, that reminds me, there was something I noticed just yesterday, I think. There's actually stories in one part of the world where prior to Christmas, it seems like the Ukraine or Russia or something, before Christmas, there's actually this, like, monster thingy that goes around eating naughty children before Christmas. And
well, then you also have Robo-Santa, who hates all of humanity and whatever he wants.
Ah, Futurama references.
Okay, for those of you who are going, what? This is a geek out reference. The Santa Claus in Futurama is Robo-Santa. That's something like, what, 2,000 years in the future? And Santa Claus coming is not a time of celebration and joy. It's a time of terror, because any humans he sees, he kills. So, you know, just remember that, you know, the good gods of the current religion turn into the demons of the next.
That's true, actually. And actually, that reminds me of a very good point. The fact that, rewinding for a second. Train of thought's gone. Associating with deities. You know what? I think now is probably a good time to play another song while we collect our thoughts again. So
we're
what I'm going
to
do...
push the font to the rails and try to get, you know, the wood thing going and stoke the fire and see if we can get back on track.
So I'm going to play Sharon Knight's Solstice Prayer from the same album, Songs for the Waning Year.
We wait in the dark for the light to appear. Mother, give birth to our brother, the sun. We wait in the dark for the light to appear. Mother, give birth to our brother, the sun. We wait, we watch. Out of the cold comes the promise of newness. We wait, we watch. Out of the cold comes the promise of day. We wait in the dark for the light to appear. Mother, give birth to our brother, the sun. We wait in the dark for the light to appear. Mother, give birth to our brother, the sun. We wait, we watch. Out of the cold comes the promise of newness. We wait, we watch. Out of the cold comes the promise of day. We wait in the dark for the light to appear. Mother, give birth to our brother, the sun. We wait in the dark for the light to appear. Mother, give birth to our brother, the sun. We wait. We watch. Out of the cold comes the promise of newness. We wait. We watch. Out of the cold.
really.
Hi, folks. So actually, one of the things that I kind of that came to mind while we were talking about Santa and his little punishing helpers was the criticism that I've heard from different corners of Tumblr and so on about the fact that teaching your kids that there's a magical, omnipotent gift giver who sees you when you're sleeping and knows when you're awake and, you know, has a list of good and bad people, etc. Kind of
and
prepared
you.
Well, that too, by originally giving you coal, which I'm actually, if you read Jan Irvin and his partner's book, Astrotheology and Shamanism, they talk about that very concept, and there's actually a kind of mushroom that is given in lieu of the Amanita, which looks like coal when it's dried out. And it's, I don't know, it's a whole different thingy. But anyway,
okay.
yeah, basically there's criticism about teaching your kids about this idea of Santa Claus because it prepares them for blind acceptance of the omnipotent punishing God in the sky who gave the gift of his son to the world, and yet will hold you to your beliefs or throw you in fire. So, I mean, basically, yeah, that was the thought that came to mind. And I guess...
To which I would like to comment for a little bit. That's bullshit, okay? Because anytime you start looking at myths and mythology and the thoughts, you're going to find a deity who is magical. You're going to find a deity who gives gifts. You're going to find a deity who punishes you and rewards you for good and bad. It's pan galactic goggle blaster, okay? It's all over humanity. This is not a unique thing to Christianity. This is not a unique thing to Islam. It's not a unique thing to Hindu. It shows up in every single culture. All right. What you have to do is you have to inoculate. If you don't want your kids growing up believing in the one Christian God who's going to divide the herd to the left hand and right hand and reward the good people and punish the sinners, then you need to be open and frank with your kids about these myths, okay? You have to make sure that they understand that the Bible, while it's a decent book and it's not a very good history, it's, you know, stories that were written down sometimes decades after the fact. Facts are wrong. Places are wrong. And the context that they're written in are very, very isolated and very, very insular. Okay? So you need to get them to understand this, that Yahweh of the Old Testament is a tribal deity who, yeah, would punish his people if they didn't do what he thought was right. But just because, you know, he grew up and turned into the omnipotent deity that sacrificed his son to himself, that it's, you know, it's the classic scapegoat myth, and then show, you know, scapegoating in just another culture, because,
well,
they all did it too, you know, and put it into context for the kids.
Well, yeah,
they're
of
not
course.
Stupid.
Well, no. Most kids aren't really stupid. But, I mean, the fact, too, is that something that Joseph Campbell was really adamant about pressing to the point was the fact that in the ancient world, myths weren't taken literally. They were true because they held truths that were significant. They weren't held as literal truth. You've got, like, if you look at the New Testament, as a series of myths that talk about very powerful ways that you should treat other people, etc., etc., instead of seeing it as literal fact, then it can be true. It can be significant and meaningful. The same thing can be held true with any other mythology. You don't have to hold it as literal fact to have it be true. It's just a different perspective.
I have a real hard time thinking that there's a tree that extends all through space, time, into heaven, and into all the depths of hell that a man hung from for 9 days, bleeding out of his eyes, and saw visions of scratch marks, and that they're the basis of all language and all wisdom. It's a wonderful allegory. It's a wonderful story. I have a real hard time thinking that that actually happened in fact. If you're going to take one culture's, if you're going to take one culture's myths as allegory and as telling a story, then you have to take all of the myths that you encounter as allegory and story.
But then
Go ahead.
Well, it comes to mind, it brings to mind this point that if you're seeing all the mythology as allegory and not literally true, then and I'm only speaking from from a perspective of someone who might be like very literalist in their approach, but it seems to me that if you want to take every story as an allegory, then how can you verify for yourself that the gods are real? I mean, doesn't that lead to atheistic paganism kind of thing?
No, it leads to a more humanistic worldview. And I'm sorry, I think in this day and age that we have to have more humanistic worldviews. I mean, this is where we're going to totally derail from Yule, and we're going to talk on other subjects for a little while.
But totally okay.
Yeah, it's so us. Like we've never done this before. You can't – the current state of humanity on the planet is killing it and killing all of us as well. And we're not just killing us now. We're killing all of us in the future. Okay, so you're talking about trillions and trillions of people. This is unsustainable, all right? People have watched the Matrix and talked about all the allegory in there and how it relates back to Christianity and everything. One of the most profound statements in there was, was uttered by the villain. He said, I've tried to categorize humanity, and they move into an area, they use up every single resource, and then they move on to destroy another area. And then he classified humanity is like a virus. They're a disease. And in sober reflection, I can't disagree with that because that's exactly what we're doing. Okay, we cannot continue the way that we're treating not only the planet, but the atmosphere and the waters and the fires and the plants and the animals, and call ourselves naturists and nature worshiping and continue doing what we're doing. It's unsustainable. Humanity is going to get hit with a huge disease. It's going to come through like the Black Plague, wipe out 90% of humanity, and you know what? That's going to be the best thing that's ever happened to the planet. And
wow.
I can't say that, I would be that upset, even though I would be dying,
And if the Georgia Guidestones are any truth holders, then the world should be maintained under a population of less than half a billion. So maybe a plague is necessary.
I've looked at alternate futures and possibilities in a lot of my meditations and a lot of the divinations that I've done. I saw a planet where there was a pandemic. It was worldwide. It wiped out 90% of humanity. One in every 10 people survived, okay, as opposed to one in every 10 persons died. There were huge swaths of every single continent that were absolutely depopulated, and the planet was recovering from the greenhouse gases, from the despoiling of all of the natural resources. The animals were recovering. All of the animals that are on the endangered species list came back strong. All of the plants that were in danger of dying out. The Amazon overgrew South America completely, and the planet recovered, and it was glorious to behold. But, you know, realizing that, you know, 90% of the people were dead was horrible. But we've got to get this attitude of we can't act like we are separate from the planet anymore. Okay, we are on the planet. We are using the planet. We are part of the planet. We are part of the system here. We were not put on the earth by Yahweh, by Odin, by Shiva, or any other deity to create plastics and to burn up trees. That's not why we're here. We were, I hate to say created, but we developed because we were one of the most successful species out there, and we have a responsibility not only to ourselves, but to future generations and to the rest of the species on the planet. That's just my opinion. Hate on me if you want, but you know, this is not something that can be continued.
Well, no, and I mean, if you want to get into an ecological standpoint for, you know, a pagan ethical system, I mean, realistically, if we are truly going to be worshippers of gods who are associated with nature, then, yeah, technically, I mean, we should be more responsible in the way that we approach daily life. And actually, I mean, you could see that from an ecological perspective and tie it to Yule, because you've got you've got these seasons, right, in most parts of the world that are, you know, away from the equator, which basically is, you know, it's sunny or it's like, I don't know, not, I guess. I have no idea. But
it's either,
you know,
hurricane or it's sunny.
I assume so, unless it's the doldrums where there just isn't any motion like that. But basically, I mean, like, as someone who basically exists within a cycle of seasons, you kind of have to look at the way the world works, right? Like, there are times when things come into existence and then, you know, pass away from existence. Things are like that. You know, species are like that. Even humanity, despite our profound arrogance that we are special somehow, that we are elevated above our own animal natures, even we as a species will have a final period where we basically die away, you know, and the Earth will continue regardless of that. It doesn't care. Mm-hmm. The Earth as a whole has no interest in our species, you know, whether we exist or not. This is just how it is. You know, it probably frightens the shit out of a lot of people to think that, you know, our species has a finite existence. But realistically, even within the vastness of the universe, our species does not matter. It never will, regardless of how far into the universe we spread. We are meaningless. You know, the species that exist on Earth now are going to come and go.
Well, when you start thinking, yeah, and as you say that, I'm reminded that scientists recently found a section of the universe that takes, I think it's something like 10 billion light years to cross from one side to the other, And it just revolutionized everything because scientists had to rethink the age of the universe. They estimate that the universe is only 13 billion years old, and yet you find something that is 10 billion light years across that's really way far away from us, and they believe that there's more of these things out there. I mean, you're starting to talk about time where you're getting up into several quadrillion years out there. So when you say that we're insignificant and we will always remain insignificant, that's true. Because even if we spread and take over the entire Milky Way, if we take over the entire Andromeda as well galaxy and take over all of the galaxies in this neighborhood, you've still got a thing out there that's 13 billion light years across that we'll never even start to penetrate, even if we get teleportation and faster than light travel, you know. And this relates back to Yule.
Because it's a season of death. Let's just be realistic.
Oh,
everything ties into
yeah.
that cycle.
Okay. Also, one of the other things that we were going to talk about was the Yule log, the Christmas tree, and those customs. Okay. Remember that the Christmas tree started out a long time ago as just a tree that people would go out and decorate at this time of the year. It would, in some cases, it would be with prayer rags. I know the Celts had a custom of tying prayers into the boughs of trees near sacred wells. And the same thing can be done, you know, in any sacred site for any tree. So you've got that. And then there was the custom of the Yule log, where they would decorate a section of log and sacrifice it in a fire to Thor, okay? And that was, you know, a present, I guess, to the gods. Don't ask me how it was a present, but this was a sacrifice to the deities, okay? I think that what wound up happening was the decoration of the tree live in the woods and the decoration of the Yule log kind of got conflated together. And then you get the custom of taking a tree out of the woods, chopping it down, bringing it into the house, decorating it inside the house. And this is where the Christmas tree actually came from. Now, I think as an extension of that, back 100 years ago, maybe 50 years ago, you have a big wood fire in the fireplace. And once you're done with decorating the tree and you have your celebration and you open up all the presents, you take the tree whole with all of its decorations and chuck it on the fire, you know. So you clean up after yourself, you get a little warmth and heat out of it, and you get a nice sacrifice as well. But that's my unverified personal gnosis again, okay? There's several, let me see. Christmas trees are always evergreen trees because the evergreen is the tree of life. It stays green all winter and gives us a feeling of hope. In ancient cultures, before Christ was born, the people used to bring them into their homes. Some evergreens can even produce flowers and fruit during the winter. Oh, that's interesting. This seemed magical to the people, of course. Evergreens are symbolic of the ending of renewed life, which is why we decorate our homes with them at Christmas time. The fetching in of the green branches is a magical rite to ensure the return of vegetation at winter's end. Our modern-day Christmas tree is the centerpiece of disbelief. Now, this comes from Urban Legends of Christmas web site. So go there and take a look at more information. But that makes sense.
It brings
you know,
to mind...
And you're... Okay.
Sorry, I was just thinking as you mentioned these evergreens that produce flowers and stuff. There's actually a really cool book called Pagan Christmas that was written by, can't think of his name offhand, but it's a great book that talks about the various plants that are associated with the holiday season. And there's one plant called the black hellebore, Helleborus niger, I believe it's called. That's also nicknamed the Christmas rose, and it's actually a flower that blooms in the snow. And then the same book talks about the poinsettia, which, you know, a lot of people up here are familiar with as a, quote, flower that we pull out only at Christmas time. But it's actually the leaves of a plant. The flowers are the little yellow stamens and buds or whatever the hell they are in the middle. But, yeah, I mean, the fact is there are a weird ton of different plants that are associated with the season because they're evergreen, etc.
Oh, yeah. I mean, look at what we decorate with. We decorate with holly and mistletoe. Does anybody stop to think why? Well, they're both blooming at this time of the year. I mean, mistletoe has flowers on it now, and it's a parasitic evergreen plant that eats the energy of other trees, and one of the trees that it will attach itself to is the oak. Okay, the oak is very tannic. You can't really do much good with it. You can eat the acorns, possibly, but mostly you use it to tan hides with. But here's a plant that is not only green when everything else is brown and dead, but, you know, it's living off of this tree that nobody else can use that attracts lightning, as it turns out. So, you know, Thor hates it. So does Zeus, you know, keeps destroying them. But it's still growing, you know, and there's snow on the ground. It's the only, it's maybe the only green thing you'll see for miles, you know, so you take it, it must be magical. You know, holly, it's, you know, got berries now during this time of the year. And, you know, something that's producing fruit, the seed pod, during the time when plants don't grow, that's amazing. It's something that, you know, the poinsettia that you mentioned. When I was little, I asked my mother why we just didn't plant the poinsettias that we bought every year at the store, because she would go out and she'd buy a big poinsettia, set it on the table. We'd have it there for about a month, and then she'd just let it die. And I didn't understand why we didn't take them and just put them in the ground, because, I mean, it's a plant. It's a pretty plant. And she was like, well, people tried to cultivate them. And about the only way that you can do it is to cut it back severely until there's next to no leaves off, cover it, stick it in a closet and forget about it until somewhere mid-November, and pull it out, and then it's alive again. You know, I can imagine this being absolutely just flabbergasting to, you know, ancient mankind. Because here you have a plant that only blooms during this time of the year. It's only alive during this time of the year when nothing else grows.
Yeah. But, I mean, I think most of the plants that are associated with this season are signs of hope for people. And, you know, I mean, obviously, the Christians jacked that because, you know, they want to create symbolism for the Christ child. But it seems to me that if you're in a culture that relies heavily on the fact that the sun will eventually return, any sign of life in the middle of winter is going to provide some small sense of hope that things can turn out. You know, that even if the winter comes, even if your family's suffering from the hardship and the cold, that there can be something beyond it, you know. And hopefully that doesn't, you know, sound like any sort of proselytization for any sort of religious belief system. But, you know, I mean, that the simple truth is, if you're in a situation where mere subsistence is a daily concern, then you're looking for that sign of hope. I mean, animals that are not hibernating through the winter are scraping the ground, you know, moving the snow just to get at sticks and roots and, you know, whatever they can find under the snow so that they can survive.
Yeah. Oh, Pagan Christmas, the Plants, Spirits, and Rituals at the Origins of Yuletide is
That's
by Christian Ratcht, R-A with two dots above it, T-S-C-H, and Claudia Mueller Ebling, E-B-E-L-I-N-G. We'll have that linked off of the permanent archive of this show so that y'all can see it. And
it really is a great book.
It looks like it.
It's so colorful. It's cool. It's like, I mean, it talks about mushrooms, because everything does. But it talks about poinsettias, talks about black hellebore, it talks about, like, holly and mistletoe and, you know, Christmas ornaments. And, it's just a fascinating book. I mean, it's one of those ones that you're going to break out every holiday season, toss under your coffee table, and hope it starts conversations. Because if you're, you know, like me, you don't have a lot to say to your family, and the sitting around together can be kind of weird and awkward because you have nothing to say. That book, sitting on your table, will inspire conversations, and people will flip through it and look at the pretty pictures, and it'll be like, wow, I never knew that. It's actually really
now,
cool.
Outstanding. Okay, I would like to talk in the, 20 minutes we have remaining on a few topics that I've seen discussed in some of the 101 books. Those of you that have been in paganism for more than about 5 years probably can go ahead and close the episode now. But all of you newbies, people who don't know, and I'm qualifying this. When I say fluffy, I mean somebody who is willfully ignorant and won't learn and refuses to learn. And when I say noob, I mean somebody who's just getting their first exposure to all of this and is willing to learn and expand their mind. Okay, so all of you noobs out there, listen up. You're going to read some of the books out there that advise you to take the standard Christmas symbolism that we grow up with when we're young and being taught by our Christian parents to, you know, rip open the packages and Santa Claus and the Christmas tree and the whole nine yards, and to convert them over into the pagan symbols and to lie to your parents or the adults in your life about what you're actually celebrating, okay? This is where I go left all over those authors and say, do not do this, okay? Why? If you have to lie about your religion, something is wrong, okay? The people that are out there don't understand about other religions other than their own, okay? They only truly understand about their own religion. And when you start encountering other people who have different religions, the wise person will start learning about that other religion so that they can relate to them, okay?
Mm-hmm.
What winds up happening is that if you're telling somebody a falsehood about your religion, then they're going to keep that falsehood and spread it. And this is how misconceptions
Inquisitions
start.
Yeah,
and inquisitions and other things like that. And it's just not—it's not good as a representative of your religion to be lying about your religion from the get-go. Okay, don't take the angels and say that the deities that you're worshiping have a pair of wings on them and therefore they're an angel. They're not, okay? The deities that you're worshiping are your deities. These are the people that you are striving throughout your life to emulate and to be the best representative you can be on the earth to them. Your every action should be in honoring of them. If you're saying to your mother, who doesn't understand about your pagan beliefs, that, oh, this is actually just Santa Claus, oh, this is just actually an angel, then you're not being a good representative. you're not educating her in what it means to be you. Okay? So my best advice is to be open, be honest. If the symbols that you're seeing and that are in the stores and that are available are close to your mental image of your deities, that's great. Use that particular symbol, but call it what it is. Okay, I have a tree topper that we got about 6 years ago, and after Christmas, we must get rid of it because we don't want to store it sale. Okay, it's a beautiful angel who had very nice large wings on it. She's dressed in burgundy and brown, has a few staffs, and just looks absolutely gorgeous, okay? The woodland-colored, poinsettia-colored angel that you usually see. We saw this in the store and went, that's perfect. We got it. We very carefully took the wings off, and that is now our altar representation of Rhiannon, because it's absolutely perfect for her without the wings. And when people come in the house, they say, oh, you got a Christmas tree ornament up still. And it's, no, that's our goddess. That's Rhiannon. What are you talking about? And if they ask, we'll say, yes, we got it at a Christmas discount. Must get rid of it. But that's our representation for our goddess. And this is another thing that, you know, happens all the time. The symbols get rebranded. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
If you want a perfect example of the rebranding of a symbol, a common symbol, the swastika that you see related to Nazism and Germany and hate and genocide and killing everybody that's different is a religious symbol in Indian mythology. It's also a symbol of eternity in Japanese mythology. The exact same symbol, okay? So it's a sun wheel from Sumeria, okay? It shows up all over. The eagle that the Nazis took and perverted into this overreaching bigot is a common symbol everywhere. The eagle is a symbol for Odin, okay? It's a symbol for
Zeus.
Flutlachithis from Celtic mythology, from Zeus, okay? The symbols get rebranded constantly. So don't tell somebody that, oh, this is an angel and we just want to keep it around. If it's your deity representation, say it's your deity representation. And if the people question you about it, educate them. It's not hard to get information about Wicca, about paganism, about your spiritual path. You found it. You encountered it. It made sense to you. It might make sense to somebody else. You don't have to convert them. They don't have to become true believers in the great power of the mystical Cernunnos and the virility of the Salus on the hills in England. Okay? They don't have to believe that. But if they can understand what you're worshiping 99% of the time, unless they're really, really just people I don't want to be around, they'll go, oh, okay, I don't agree with that. I think you're a nut, but that's something that you believe, and not my kink.
Everything comes back to that at some point.
It does.
Yeah, I
it's
mean...
like,
if you want to get a print on your wall of the Cernavis giant, who is that naked dude with a giant heart on the hill in England, then go for it. You know, use that as a representation of the god who, you know, comes back every year. You know, put it out at, you know, Beltane. Shit. I mean, there's times that any of the most unusual symbols that you want to use are appropriate and you can get away with. People aren't going to ask you, or they're going to be too weirded out by it to ask.
We'll get back to you in just a second. As a really simple question, if the people that you're associating with have a problem with your faith and with what you believe and the symbols that you use to show them. Are they really the kind of people that you want to associate with for the rest of your life?
It's true. I mean, you can choose your family. Well, you can't choose them specifically. You're genetically tied to them, but you can choose the people you celebrate your holidays with. And, you know, if you're going to choose between hostile people who constantly belittle you for believing what you do or the people who are like-minded, hell, I would choose the people who are like-minded. But that's me. You know, blood or not, the simple fact is the people you want to share your holidays with ought to be the ones that want to be there.
Mm-hmm. I mean, just out of my own life as an example, my father was raised as a Baptist. He is very fundamental in a lot of his beliefs. Okay, my mother was raised as a Methodist, as far as I can tell. Not really that big into it. But she found the Mormon church when I was 11 years old. And to get her approval, I joined the Mormon church too. Well, my three sisters also joined it. So we have one Baptist and we have five Mormons in the same household. Okay. This was not a recipe for a good time. I became an atheist. I became an agnostic, really, right around 18, and got involved in Wicca when I was 20. Okay, I'm 45 now, just so that you have a time period. When I started investigating it, I didn't go out and advertise it. I didn't yell it to the universe, even though I wanted to. But it became a permanent part of my life, and it started getting reflected in everything that I did. When Mary and I got together and we got married, we were going to have a very pagan hand fasting. We named our daughter after a goddess. We started pulling in symbols of our faith in our household. We discussed it when we were asked about it, but we didn't shove it into people's faces. Unfortunately, my mother and sisters decided that this meant that we were deceived by Satan and they needed to rescue our daughter for the glory of God. And so when she would go over to their house, they would start teaching her about Jesus and God and everything. And it finally came to a head at one point where our six-year-old little girl looks at both of us and says, well, when I'm here, I will believe in the Lord and Lady, and when I'm at Grandma's house, I will pray to Jesus. And we both looked at each other and went, that's it. And we cut ties at that point. And when it finally came to a head and my mother and sisters were like, well, why won't you let us see your daughter? We said, look, we've asked you several times not to proselytize to a six-year-old. You continue to do it. And in the interest of keeping our sanity and keeping our tranquility and remaining true to our gods, we have decided not to let you have access to our daughter anymore. And we shamelessly used the grandchild club. And they got the message. They stopped proselytizing to her. And we've gotten over the years to the point where we can discuss our religious differences. We can discuss things like mythology. We will still be polite and we will still be respectful at their religious ceremonies when we wind up with them, like at Thanksgiving or Easter or whatever. And they are respectful of ours. Now, we've given them enough information that they're not threatened by it anymore. But it's still, you know, we had to make those overtures, and we had to be willing to cut all ties, as painful as it was, simply to make the point that we're not going to put up with you circumventing us. And in one case with my father, we actually had to sever ties completely because he can't get to the point of being civil about it. He has to proselytize. He has to try to convert us back to Christianity because I'm leading my family down the path of damnation, you know. And by his beliefs, that's exactly what's happening. But you know what? By my beliefs, we're living a moral life that, you know, is very, very full. It's just without him. So,
exactly.
You know, if you're having to lie, you know, you've got to really figure out what's more important. Is your religion more important, or is keeping the approval of somebody that's belittling you and won't understand and won't talk to you more important? Okay? Now, you can be discreet without lying. There is a difference between discretion and out-and-out fictions. If you have, say, a Christmas tree topper of an angel, and you pulled the wings off, and it's now your altar figure of Rhiannon, for instance. And you're under 15, you're living with your mom and dad in their house, and they come in and they see it sitting on your dresser and want to know why it's there. You don't have to jump up and say, oh, it's Rhiannon. You don't have to say, oh, it's an angel. You can say, it's a pretty decoration. I like it there. You can keep your altar dressing, your tools and things, in a drawer. Most likely, if your parents are anything like mine, they're going to find it eventually, and they'll ask you about it. Why do you have this knife? Why do you have this this dish of salt? Why do you have this? Okay? And this is going back to using things that are in the household that can be easily disposed of or easily hidden or will go back into common stores. Because if you take a little dish and you take some table salt and you dump it into that and you do your ritual, you can dump the salt back into the big salt can and put the dish away. You don't have to keep it on your dresser, okay?
Sure.
Just to eliminate a point of contention between you and your parents. But if they walk in and you're doing a ritual and you have your altar all laid out, don't say, oh, I'm just listening to rock albums, you know, because mm-hmm. then they know something's going on.
Especially if you're practicing Skyclad, it's kind of awkward to try and dismiss it like that. And you know what? Something that comes to mind, too, is one of the least contentious, I guess, gifts that you can give to someone at this time of year that will have profound symbolism that relates, I mean, through mankind's history, is the gift of a beeswax candle. I mean, if you're stuck for gift ideas for someone that you know isn't going to like your particular religion, you can give them a gift that's non-denominational, that is a symbol of the time of the year, in the gift of a beeswax candle. It's a beautiful gift, and you can decorate it if you want. You can, you know, provide any sort of candle holders or whatever if you're into that. And they'll appreciate the beauty of it.
Or you can just go secular completely and, you know, do something like a gift card or
that's
clothes or something.
Always possible, too. But yeah, I mean, we've got like 5 minutes left of our show tonight, and I guess this is probably a good time to mention that starting in January, with our next show, actually, January the whatever the hell it is.
Second. January 2nd.
Is it really? Good Lord. Right after
yes.
New Year's.
Right after
gonna
New Year's.
Going to be all hungover and shit. But anyway, yeah, we're going to be... What are we talking about, runes or something?
We're doing the runes. What happened was is that we had figured that we were going to do runes last week. It was going to go Asatru in the Northern tradition, then runes, then Yule. But when we switched to an every other week format, what wound up happening was runes was going to be tonight, then Yule 2 days later, and then we were going to talk about Yule right after New Year. And I went, you know, that's really stupid. So I switched the two of them, put Yule back on tonight, and we'll talk about runes 2 weeks from now on the 2nd.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, what we're going to do is we're actually moving the show off of Blog Talk Radio, not necessarily because we don't enjoy being on BTR, but because it's basically more cost-effective to host the show pre-recorded on our own website, magicalmusings.net. And, you know, that given that we didn't have a lot of callers in or chatters in the little chat room, I mean, it really isn't affecting anyone. So we won't be able to have the shows play on the embedded players on at least my web or on my blog and on the web Woodwurst Radio blog, but we'll have them available on magicalmusings.net so that we can.
And I'm going to do the best I can to set up an iTunes podcast account so that if you really want it live streaming, as it's, you know, supposed to be broadcast at 8 p.m. Eastern time, you'll have that option through iTunes, and possibly a few other publishers as well, if I can find them. Anyway, go ahead.
But yeah, it's something we're looking into for the new year. So we want to wish you and yours a happy Yule, a Merry Christmas, a Happy New Year.
Happy
talk
Hanukkah,
to you guys in the new year.
Happy Festivus. What? Happy
exactly.
Christmas Quantica year.
Oh, happy Kwanzaa too. Now that I think
yes.
about it, yeah, that's coming up as well. But yeah, I mean, whatever you're celebrating at this time of year, enjoy it. Enjoy the people you're surrounded with, and we'll see you in the new year.
All right.
Have
Y'all
a good
have
night,
a good
folks.
Time.
Enjoy yourselves, folks. Bye-bye.